Coming up on Tech News Weekly, a look into the story behind Cambridge Analytica, start to finish. Maybe not that comprehensive, but we dive into its history. Also, Facebook is making changes to its relationship with third-party aggregators. How Apple's education effort stacks up and compares to Chromebooks in the classroom. And using technology to teach kids about money management. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 25, recorded Thursday, March 29th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Kubernetes Engine on Google Cloud Platform. You'll learn more at g.co/getgke today.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where we talk to the people breaking and making the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. We're going to break some Facebook today.
But first, I just want to say, if have an iPhone X and you have downloaded the update 11.3, please go check out the new Animoji, because there's nothing more important in tech news that happened besides that.
Yes, I heard the new Animoji today, rather it was you talking into an Animoji and then looped like 20 times. Which was awesome.
Yeah, I share it on Twitter, so go check out Twitter, Megan Maroney on Twitter.
So, first, a very late apology, because I left on vacation almost 2 weeks ago, and then all hell broke loose with Facebook. So, obviously, you can blame me for all of that. On second thought, I want nothing to do with any of it, but let's talk about it anyway. Facebook has been looking inward, as it's used to doing these days, trying to see how it can make changes that will satisfy those crying foul about its cavalier data practices. And joining us to talk about its latest move is, welcoming back to the show, Kurt Wagner from Recode. How's it going, Kurt?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you back once again. You wrote about how Facebook is cutting itself off from third-party data aggregators that it used in the past to enhance its own ad platform. So why don't we start there? Why is Facebook making this change? What instrument have those third-party aggregators actually played in how Facebook serves its ads?
So this is one of those really wonky ad tech stories that has been surprisingly popular the last 24 hours or so since we wrote it, and other people have jumped on that as well. But basically, there were three ways to target someone on Facebook if you were an advertiser. You could use data that Facebook has based on, you know, user profiles. You could go in and you could bring your own data. So if you had, you know, a customer list, a bunch of emails from people who have signed up or given that to you, you could bring that and use that to target people. Or you could use this data from these third-party services like Experian, or Axiom. And what that did was it basically supplemented those other two data sets. And so these big third-party data firms primarily are known for collecting what's called offline data, right? So do you own a house? Or what did you buy at the grocery store last week? So that kind of data, if you're an advertiser and you're trying to, you know, directly target someone, it might be very helpful to know that kind of stuff. And so Facebook has been selling targeted ads while using that kind of data. And yesterday they decided, hey, we're not going to do that anymore, primarily because we don't know where these third-party data providers actually get their information. We don't vet it. They're big. In some cases, they're publicly traded companies, so it's not like they're nobodies. At the same time, I think Facebook is saying, we want to have total control over the data that we are using, and we can't do that if we're using third-party data providers.
So I have an idea of what Experian does, but Axiom, now are they the people that are connected to like the rewards card? So like if I go to Safeway and I have a rewards card, maybe I'm saving $5, but I'm also handing over, you know, all my buying data. Is that connected to Axiom or is that totally separate?
So I'm not a pro at Axiom either, but the way it was described to me is, yes, it's basically a lot of these loyalty programs that you might be part of at your local grocery store or local retailer are actually powered and provided by these third-party data providers. That's how they get that purchase history, right? That's how they know you just bought potato chips at Safeway is because you logged in with your loyalty account at the register. So I can't speak to Axiom specifically only because I'm still learning about this stuff. I mean, this is not like mainstream common knowledge. These companies are not, you know, Facebooks and Googles, right? That's my long way of saying I don't know Axiom specifically, but you're right. Those kinds of programs are what we're talking about.
And it's almost by design that we know very little about companies like that. They work, I mean, largely, you know, their purpose is to work behind the scenes. You do what you do and, you know, give us the information that we need, which is kind of what all of this centers around. Did Facebook ever really need this information to begin with? Like, does this really change very much about what Facebook is doing? Because, I mean, when it comes to, advertising, the modern kind of efforts around advertising and data collection, all that kind of stuff, Facebook's one of the kings in the room as far as that's concerned. Did they ever need this data to begin with?
I tried to ask that question yesterday. I talked to some people who are much smarter than I am about this and was actually told that that data can be very important in certain segments of advertising. So consumer packaged goods was the example that was given to me. If you sell most of your product through a brick and mortar retailer, right? So I'll stick with this potato chip example. You make potato chips and you sell them at Safeway and you sell them at other grocery stores. Safeway and those other grocery stores are the ones knowing who's actually buying your chips, right? You're kind of one level removed. So in that case, if you wanted to advertise, you might not have the kind of customer data that you really need to be targeted with your advertising. So that is like the one industry that I was continually pointed back to, is saying, hey, it's important for consumer packaged goods companies. At the same time, how important can it be overall to Facebook's business if they were just willing to cut it out, right like that, right? I imagine that they either think, A, they have enough data of their own, B, their advertisers can bring enough of their own personal, company data to supplement this, to the fact that they don't feel that they need the third party. So long way of saying, I think it's important depending on the industry, but clearly not important enough for Facebook to keep it around.
So do you think that this, I mean, in addition to the third party the getting rid of those third party folks, they changed some of the privacy, the way they tried to make it easier for you to adjust your privacy settings on Facebook, which we've heard before. Do you think that, I mean, is that, it seems to me like they're not really taking this as seriously as they could. I mean, those were really just kind of to appease regulators, right? The changing of the privacy settings.
Yeah, that's how I read it. I think they were cosmetic changes. So, I do see value for sure in saying, hey, if you want to look at your privacy settings, if you want to change them, if you want to delete something, you can do that all from one place. I see a lot of value in that. At the same time, I think this is a redesign, and that's what it was called. It's not a restructuring of what Facebook collects or how they use it necessarily. So I think as long as people look at it through that lens and say, okay, this is somewhat helpful, but it's not the only thing Facebook's doing, I think it's okay. I do think that there are some regulatory reasons they did this, specifically the GDPR stuff in the EU. You know, part of those rules and things that Facebook's going to have to kind of bone up on is making sure that they're being very clear and transparent about what they're collecting and giving users a chance to come in and actually either download that data and take it with them somewhere else or delete it altogether. So I think that's what this is a big part of Facebook's changes are actually from the GDPR stuff. The timing just worked out that, you know, they were able to kind of kill two birds with one stone by announcing it very shortly after the Cambridge Analytica situation.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the second article that we showed off that Megan was just talking about the access your information section. All of this, like you said, it's information that was accessible before. Now it's just wrapped up into a new package, which I feel like Facebook does very regularly, actually, because their privacy, you know, their privacy implications of their service are such, it's such a convoluted web. It's really hard to package it up in a way that everybody understands it. Do you think that what they're doing here, I mean, is it an effective approach compared to their previous efforts on really clarifying something that's as clear as mud?
I think they've also said that they're going to rewrite some of those privacy settings and terms to hopefully make them easier for people to understand. I think that would go a lot farther even than just putting them all in one place. I think that, you know, the last thing anyone wants to do when they're signing up for a new service is to sit there and read 10 pages of 6-point font around, you know, all of the legalese around what company is going to do with their data. So I think that they could probably do a much better job of just making that simpler and making it easier to comprehend for, you know, your basic average Facebook user. So I would love to see them do that in addition to this. I don't think they're done here. I think this is the beginning of a lot of different changes they're going to make that will hopefully add up to be helpful in the long term. But right now, you know, if you take this just on a surface, it doesn't seem like much. I think if you view it as a piece of many things to come, you know, it helps.
If I were to be able to write the privacy settings for Facebook or anything on the internet, I would basically just say nothing is ever private, not ever, ever, never, never, never. The end.
But share right. everything that you possibly can through us, please.
Right. There's probably a reason they don't hire you to write their privacy settings after that one. But yeah, that's usually a good rule of thumb for those of you out there who are new to the internet. Don't put it on the internet. If you don't want it to show up somewhere where it's out of your control.
Yeah. So we've been talking about that, you know, for years we've been talking about how Facebook is this sort of black box and we don't know how they work. And so that's difficult for us to be able to know anything, who they're sharing our data with, because they just don't share. But now what you're saying is, like, the reason they're getting rid of Axiom and Experian and other third parties is because they don't know what they're sharing their data with. And we knew they didn't know what Cambridge Analytica was doing with their data, and that when they said they deleted it, they believed them and they were wrong. So is it true to assume that really, like, this is an out of control monster, and it's not that just it's this black box that Mark Zuckerberg is, you know, holding really tightly like this, that it's just it's everywhere and they have no more control over it?
I do think that there's a fair criticism of Facebook and other tech companies to say you underestimated the kind of wheels you put in motion here, right? You underestimated the power that you would have, the influence that you would have, the trust perhaps that users would give you and hand over without kind of thinking twice or agreeing to things without actually reading them. So I think there's definitely a fair criticism to say, hey, some of these companies were naive and they were a little ignorant to what they were actually doing. At the same time, I think some of it actually has to fall back on consumers. And I know that's not a very popular thing to say, but, you know, we are people who are making choices to hand over a lot of this information. It may be prompted for you to do it. They may ask in a way that, you know, you feel is tricky or deceptive. And I think that's a fair criticism. At the same time, you know, half of this has to fall on, or at least part of this has to fall on general consumers to make sure that they're being smart about what they hand over. And then you put it on the companies to treat that information in the way they promise to treat it. So I think it's a little bit of like everyone could improve here. But I think those companies, given that they're so big, that they make so much money off of that data, they're certainly held to a higher standard than anybody else.
Yeah, and I mean, the challenge with a story like this, I actually just wrote or read an article prior to coming here. I can't remember which publication it was. I wish I could remember off the top of my head. But
probably
it was
Recode, Jason, recode.net.
The only place.
Perhaps.
It's a really great site. I don't know if you guys have heard of it. Lots of great news and analysis.
You can see it on such shows as this one in the lower third and the guests that we're talking to right now. But it was an interview. It was a woman reporter who interviewed her mom about the Cambridge Analytica perspective, and I think what that really proved is that, you know, this story in particular, like, it's so complicated, right? Like, it's really hard to just drop right into the Cambridge Analytica sphere of a story and understand beginning to end all of the implications that it actually raises, and will that push everyday user of Facebook, person who doesn't follow or isn't passionate about technology enough to read up about this constantly, is that going to be enough for them to realize what is at stake? And from that, you know, decide, like, do I want to continue using Facebook? Is this a good idea? Or am I okay with what's happening? It's really hard to pick out those details based on the complexity of the story itself and just how the ad machinations behind the scene actually work. This is just the way it works on the internet today.
There is so much nuance to this story and so many details that kind of require a really basic foundational level of understanding of not just Facebook service, but how the ad industry works, yeah. right? How digital advertising operates. And I think one of the things that's really jumped out to me is how many people I've heard say, oh, well, Facebook sells my data. Facebook doesn't sell anybody's data. They use that data to, you know, target you with ads, but in a perfect world, they keep that data to themselves. It's incredibly valuable. That's why Facebook is such a tremendous advertising platform, is that they have that and others don't, right? So yeah. That is a very high level example of an obvious, you know, misunderstanding about how Facebook's business works and how the digital advertising industry works. So I think that is just one of many. So this has really opened my eyes to, one, there needs to certainly be more conversations about this kind of stuff. It's very important. Two, companies need to be clearer about what they're doing and what they're not doing. But also three, like folks like myself and those in the industry could also do a better job of translating what companies say to the general public, because that's part of our job too, is to kind of read through the corporate speak and BS and hopefully relay things in a way that's comprehensible. So it's not going to get easy or fixed right away. I think this is a sign that there's a lot more people need to understand.
One way to get that effective translation is to follow Kurt Wagner on Recode.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt, for joining us once again. We really appreciate your time as always. Right. And we'll talk to you soon. Keep up the
great work. Take care, guys.
Take care.
The piece you're referring to is Ashley Feinberg in Huffington Post.
There we go. Thank you. I knew someone would come up with that, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
So last week, I asked you for your selfies, and you delivered. Keep sending them. Keep them coming. TNW at twit.tv. Here is Ben listening to TNW while on a plane. He says, I'm off to San Jose for the GPU Technology Conference.
How do we know he's listening to TNW? We just see those earplugs.
True.
The earphones.
It's true. We don't know.
Yeah. We'll take him for his word. Yeah. And here is Eric, who says, my iPad Pro is always tuned to Twit Live or playing a podcast at the very least. While I'm from and live in northern Canada, Fort McMurray, Alberta to be exact, I frequently visit my family's second home in Phoenix. Next time I have a few extra days, I'll be making the trip to Petaluma to watch live and hopefully meet some of the Twit crew. And we hope that you do. Please do stop by. Say hi.
And here is Penny, who says, I teach iPad classes here in Saddlebrook, Arizona, an active adult community outside of Tucson. Here's a picture of me and my assistant. And you can see her assistant has a tiny little iPad also.
I wonder if... Oh. Wow.
It's really a makeup compact, she said, which I did not know that existed.
That is awesome.
I want one, but she put a piece of paper over the screen, so that her assistant could really assist her.
Yeah.
Earlier this week, Apple held an event in Chicago focused on education. Carolina Milanese is a former VP at Gartner Research and currently a consumer tech analyst at Creative Strategies, and she was at the event. Welcome, Carolina.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. So we, for those of you watching, we just have a picture of Carolina today, but I want to, I'm so excited to talk to you because you have so much of a background in this field, and I know you were at the event. So just let's start with your biggest takeaway from the Apple event.
I thought it was interesting how Apple tried to redefine education. And what I mean is that very often, I'm an analyst, but I'm a mom too. I have a 10-year-old in fourth grade. And I think that every parent has battled with homework, has battled with having their kids engaged in what they're learning. And that, to me, was the biggest focus for Apple, trying to give teachers tools that will allow them to bring to life their curriculum and get the kids engaged, but also give them the skills that they will need for when they're ready to go to work, right? What we learn, and I'm showing my age by saying this, but I learn how to type and short handwriting and these kind of things that are absolutely useless, or most of them are today, right? And that's kind of a feel for the next generation. And so Apple had a chance this week to tell their story about what matters to them when it comes to education, that to me had more to do with educating per se than not education as a market segment.
And so I know a lot of people were caught up in the cost of these devices. And you wrote that like no one expected the iPad to be, you know, to go as low as the Google Chromebooks. But they were, you know, they touted the $299 price for the iPad for schools only. But then if you add the Apple Pencil and a case and a keyboard, it can come up, it can be pretty high, really out of the, you know, when you think about the classrooms that we hear about that can't afford Kleenex. So what would you say about the price of these new products?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to look at this and not think that, you know, Apple has a bit of a elitist way of looking at education. But in reality, I think it's really around what you as a teacher or as a school want to do with these devices. If what you're going to use a device for is mainly writing papers, then by all means, invest in a cheaper device that gives you a good productivity suite like Chromebooks, though. You know, G Suite for Education is a great collaboration and a productivity suite that schools are very happy with. Do that. If instead you want to look at a device that allows you also to have a camera integrated in it, it allows you to create video clips with different apps, not just the app that Apple has been putting forward, which is Clips, and now has a great AR platform, augmented reality platform, where the coolest thing I saw on Tuesday was this app called Frogipedia, where you can actually dissect a frog without having to kill a frog or smell formaldehyde, which is good. You know, it's a win-win situation for everybody. But, you know, so if you look at more engaging with different part of your curriculum and having different tools from drawing to video to music via GarageBand, then I think you're looking at that $299 price point in a different way. But there's no question that for a lot of school, $299 plus, like you were saying, you know, add, even if you don't want Apple Pencil and you're going for the Logitech crayon is another $50 and then $99 for the case, you know, the cost goes up. But from a school perspective, the other part to take into account is how long you want to hang on to these devices, right? So are you making an investment that will last you 3 or 4 years and then, you know, nobody ever questions the quality of Apple product nor Logitech product for that matter. So you're looking at that investment too and a total cost of ownership of the device.
That's an interesting point that I hadn't really actually considered in light of the announcement this week. Is that, I mean, we have here in the U.S., Chromebooks are by and large probably the most popular classroom device right now. What is the length of time that those devices are active and used? Are we still, is it still too early to know how long that lasts? We understand as users of Apple products just how long of a lifespan Apple products usually have. So we have, you know, the faith to at least assume that these devices would last that long, if not longer, in the classroom. But what about the usable lifespan of these Chromebooks that are by and large everywhere in U.S. schools right now?
So the good thing with the Chromebooks is that there's very little that is of the goodness that you get that is actually on the hardware side, right? It's all coming from the software. And I think that's what the beauty of it is. But and also because they're all connected, that part and the cloud plays almost a bigger part than not what you have on the actual hardware in your hands. I think, though, we are getting to a point where there are new technologies like augmented reality and virtual reality that schools are starting to experiment with. And so knowing how well, you know, something that is already 2 years old will live up to that is still a bit of a question. But in general, you know, I think from an iPad, expecting 3 to 4 years is the norm. And for Chromebooks, you're probably on kind of a 3 year lifespan.
So what about ClassKit? I know you wrote a little bit about, you know, personalized learning, and that's big in Silicon Valley. And, you know, it's it really is something that we think about as parents, like, you know, every kid is different. And how can we educate them all? How does ClassKit help with that?
It helps by really helping bringing together all the teachers are using from an application perspective. I think that one of Apple's problems was that when it came to the education, it felt like they had different features and different bits and pieces, if you like, but not a coherent end-to-end solution. And now they do. So there's the hardware, there's school manager that allows you to set up your students with Apple IDs and really deploy, hundreds of iPads in a matter of minutes. And then you have Classwork and ClassKit, and those are kind of linked. So Classwork allows you to do handouts and to make sure that if you give a homework that asks your students to go into an app and do a specific exercise, you can actually embed a hard link in the homework package so that they know exactly where to go and you don't have to explain it or, you know, be worried that they're not going to be able to find it. And ClassKit allows developers for education to come up with almost like a way to evaluate how engaged the students are, how they're making progress. And the teacher has a view per app and across apps too. Because I think that's the other side of bringing technology to the classroom, right? That you're bringing all of this stuff, but are you sure you're making a difference? You know, you can see engagement, you can see this, but are they learning? And so now you have a way to do that and also have a way to adjust how you use different apps, you know, depending on how your students are responding to a particular one. You know, there's a lot of choice. They talked about over 200,000 educational apps in the App Store. So making it easier for teachers to see what works and what doesn't work is a great help.
Yeah, and Apple has a strength in, you know, both iPad and on the Mac OS side of things, where they create software that's really well thought out and really kind of, you know, coexists with other apps that they've created really well. This seems like it falls in line exactly with Apple's ability to pull that off. But of course, you have the fact, like we were talking about earlier, that there is no ultra affordable iPad solution at the end of the day.
Right.
Does Apple need this to compete directly with Chromebook, or are they okay with the fact that, like, yes, this will be in less classrooms, but that's good enough? Like that actually satisfies our objectives here.
I think it does. I don't think, you know, anybody ever kind of sets themselves to sell less than what they can, right? So I don't think that if you ask Apple, they say, well, no, of course they want
right.
the biggest market share they can get. But I think it's a question of impact that they're having versus a question of market share in this case. And the discussion that we can have is not actually that different from the discussion on the consumer market for iPhone, right? For the longest time, people have been saying, oh, if Apple only came out with a $300 or $400 iPhone, they could get more people in emerging markets. They could get more people on a prepaid plan. But they don't want that. They don't necessarily want to get people that they are not going to be able then to take advantage of everything else that Apple has from an ecosystem perspective. And I think for the school system is similar. It's about making a big impact on reinventing education for those schools that have the ability to do that, not just financially, because that's only part of it, right? I was saying in my piece, if you ask any teacher, there are two things they never have enough, money and time, right? And so being able to give them tools that cut back on the time they need to invest from an administration perspective, which is what Chromebooks do well as well for schools, I think that's important. So I think it's more about impact than not market share.
Mm-hmm.
So my kids in the Petaluma School District, they have school-issued iPads and Google Classroom. So, you know, they use mm-hmm. Docs and they use Sheets and all that. But then they also have GarageBand, which they use a lot. And they have Swift Playgrounds for coding. And to me, like, that's the greatest combination of the two. I mean, why wouldn't... I don't think that Apple would ever allow Swift Playgrounds or GarageBand to be available on Chromebooks. I don't know... But do you think they ever would be?
No.
And what's the simple reason why they wouldn't do that?
And I think, well, for Swift Playground, you're kind of, if you like, starting to groom your next kind of generation of developers, right, for iOS. And so that's where that environment comes from. And for GarageBand is a very differentiated offering that they have. It plays very well with the capability of the iPad. And, you know, for them... if you look at things like iMessage and how successful iMessage is for iPhone, why not open it up to Android devices? Because they don't want it, because it is something that should come as a, an added bonus because you're spending the money you're spending on the hardware, right? So for a long time, Apple has been creating software that brought value to the hardware investment that you were making. Now things are changing a little bit because they need to differentiate more from that hardware and services when it comes from revenue. And so trying to monetize more from that services directly versus the just adding value to the hardware. So they might open up some things, but I doubt that they'll go to the extent that you're suggesting. Google, on the other end, is happy to have G Suite work very nicely on an iPad because that's what they want. They want the engagement, not on the device per se, but they want the engagement on their services. They want people to be in their cloud. They want them to use Gmail, and they want to continue to do that when they leave school and they get into the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're really pushing the idea that, you know, you can use it on your iPad, you can use it on your laptop, you can use it on your, you know, parents' Windows laptop, or, you know, wherever Absolutely. You want. Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense. Carolina, thank you so much for joining us. I have you in writing that you promised to come back again. So
I did.
Carolina Milanese is formerly a VP at Gartner Research. She's currently a consumer tech analyst at Creative Strategies. We will link to all of her thoughts on the event. Thank you so much for joining us, Carolina.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
All right, up next, we're going to dive into some of the looming regulatory aspects that have come out of the Facebook Cambridge Analytica story. We're not done talking about that story yet with Andy Kroll from Mother Jones. But first, we want to thank the sponsor of this episode of Tech News Weekly, and that is Kubernetes Engine on Google Cloud Platform. When you're building an application, you need it to be fast, secure, and always evolving. With Kubernetes Engine, developers can easily deploy containerized apps on a fully managed service from Google Cloud Platform. Google has been running production workloads in containers for more than 10 years, and they build the best of what they learn into Kubernetes Engine. Kubernetes Engine combines automatic scaling, updates, and reliable self-healing infrastructure with open source flexibility to cut down your development cycles and move from idea to production quickly and reliably. Kubernetes Engine handles scheduling deployment for your workloads to maximize resource optimization so you can focus on your apps, of course. Auto-scaling allows you to handle increased demand of your services and will scale back down in the quiet periods to save you money. Google is the only hyperscale cloud provider to offer an SLA for clusters running on Kubernetes. It's also backed by experts on Google's security and reliability engineering team and is both HIPAA and PCI compliant. Worried about getting locked in with Kubernetes Engine? You're free to take your workloads out and run them anywhere. Kubernetes is supported. Learn more about Kubernetes Engine at g.co/getgke today. That's g.co/getgke. And one more time, if you missed it the first two, g.co/getgke. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly.
This week, the FTC confirmed their investigation of the data privacy practices at Facebook. In the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, the press first reported that Mark Zuckerberg would not testify before Congress and then reported that he would. Apparently, something convinced him he needed to be there. Joining us to discuss the ongoing war over our personal data a little bit more is investigative reporter Andy Kroll, who has been following the story for Mother Jones. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So at issue here is the report, of course, that Facebook turned over data of 50 million people and then it was misused. And then when Facebook found out, they asked the company to delete the data, but then they never followed up to confirm that Cambridge Analytica actually did delete it. Now, this is shocking to a lot of us, but it's actually not the first time Facebook has been investigated by the FTC. Can you tell us a little bit about the first time?
Yeah, if you go back, going on 7-8 years now, the data practices at Facebook and the ability to access the personal data of Facebook users was an issue for Facebook with the Federal Trade Commission. The ability to extract that data from Facebook and to, you know, then slice it and dice it and use it however you liked became an issue at the company, and it led to this agreement with the FTC. I think this would have been about 7 years ago, that Facebook would give better disclosure, that it would be more transparent with regulators about how it's was using and giving access to the vast amounts of data that we all put into Facebook by being users on the platform. And now that consent agreement, consent decree between Facebook and the FTC is coming back into play with these new revelations that Facebook, again, allowed outside users connected to Cambridge Analytica to get as much as 50 million profiles of Facebook users, the data on those profiles, and that Facebook did not do it either, did not disclose this properly, and did not do a good enough job of tracking it down after the fact.
So I want to talk about your investigative piece, which everyone should go read at Mother Jones. Even if you think you know everything about this story, you don't.
Yeah,
I feel like now that we can't watch a House of Cards, I'll just read this and call it a day.
So true. There's going to be a movie made about this at some point, guaranteed.
So tell us about Cambridge Analytica, like the stuff that we don't already know. Where did they get started, and what was their original mission?
Sure. So this story takes us back to about 2012, I think, is where I would start this story. And that is, you have a fellow over in London named Alexander Nix. He is working for a company called SCL. It's a British company. They're in public affairs. They have a defense/military division. But Alexander Nix is looking for a way into the American political market. This is a $10 billion booming industry. And this fellow with this British company is looking for his way in. And he sees his way in when Mitt Romney loses the presidential election in 2012. And one of the culprits is that the Republican Party is drastically trailing its Democratic opponents in the worlds of data and technology. And so Alexander Nix goes searching for a way to bring what he thinks is the cutting edge technology and advances in data to the Republican Party. He eventually links up with Robert and Rebecca Mercer, and these are two of the big mega donors in Republican politics. Robert Mercer, of course, pioneered the use of algorithms in hedge fund investing. And what Alexander Nix came to Robert Mercer and said is, hey, look, you know algorithms, you know big data. What I want to do is take some of those same approaches, and I want to apply algorithms, and I want to apply psychology to politics. And out of this meeting and out of this relationship, Cambridge Analytica is born. You can even see it in the name. You have Cambridge, which kind of stands for the old, you know, wise universities of England. And then Analytica is a sort of James Bond-esque, futuristic, a phraseology, completely made up word, of course, but you combine those two, you get Cambridge Analytica. And as my story shows, Cambridge Analytica finds its way into American politics, preaching these cutting edge approaches to targeting voters, influencing voters, turning out voters. But there are real questions about whether Cambridge Analytica's success, whether it actually worked, what it was pitching, or whether it was just good at convincing people with a lot of money to underwrite this company.
Yeah, it's really fascinating reading through the entire story and the timeline of events. And I feel like because we were talking earlier in this show, Cambridge Analytica and everything that's happening with Facebook, it's a very complicated, complex story. You have to understand a little bit about how online marketing works. You have to understand a little bit about how data is being used to drive elections or leading up to an election to kind of understand voters and all that kind of stuff. In 2015, The Guardian had posted about Ted Cruz's presidential campaign, which you point out in the article. You know, Ted Cruz was kind of an early user of Cambridge Analytica's data to this degree and to this level. Ultimately, didn't work out so well for him. But The Guardian had posted about this in 2015. And then, of course, in 2016, shortly after President Trump was elected, in the New York Times, there was also a piece that kind of detailed how these machinations were happening behind the scenes. Why was there, I mean, it seems like we knew a lot then, and, you know, a lot of this similar information that we know now. What's different now that has regulators kind of focused in on Facebook at this point, where they weren't prior? I mean, we knew this information then. What's different?
We did know this information, and I'm glad that you noted that December 2015 Guardian story. In retrospect, that Guardian story looks prophetic.
Yes.
And was in some way, to use a cliche, the canary in the coal mine. That really, I mean, I kept coming back to the story myself in my reporting. And I think in that moment, I mean, Facebook supposedly went to the Cruz campaign and went to Cambridge Analytica and the other players involved with this data question. After that story came out, and very quietly, privately said, this is a problem. You need to delete this data. You need to take care of this. Now, Facebook didn't seem to go too far out of its way to verify that when the players involved, so the data was deleted, that it actually was. But I do think Facebook grasped the magnitude, or part of the magnitude, of what had happened and what the larger ramifications of that could be with that December 2015 story. But they kept it quiet, as did the campaigns and the other people involved. And in a way, it kind of happened that the story happened. There was a little flurry of information, and then it receded. And I really don't think it was until we had Christopher Wiley, the former Cambridge Analytica employee, early employee, right there in the thick of all of the discussions and activities about how this trove of Facebook data was procured, until he really went public just in the last couple of weeks, when this whole thing blew up, that we understood the magnitude of it. We understood why that data was so important, that personal Facebook data was so important to Cambridge Analytica, and what they had intended to do with it. We did not have the full picture of what was going on there. And I also think that in the ensuing years since that Guardian story came out, there has just been a growing broader awareness of Facebook has all this data. Facebook monetizes all this data. This is Facebook's business model, and just the general issues of privacy and what, so those of us who use Facebook, Twitter, Google, what we've opted into. I just think the awareness of that has grown to the point that when Christopher Wiley went public with all this information, the reception, you know, it was an explosion and sent Facebook stock tumbling, the FTC investigating. There were a lot of things building up to this, I think.
What surprised me as well was, you write about the 2016 conference, the Concordia Annual Summit in Manhattan, which you describe as TED meets Davos. And you talk about how Alexander Nick spoke at that conference and talked a little bit about this. This is, of course, after the 2015 article, but your description just makes me think, like, he's like, you know, you can't believe what we can do with this data. I mean, he talks about how they know if people are very low in neuroticism or quite, or openness or slightly conscientious. And I mean, there are important people at this event. I mean, you talk about speakers like Kristen Gillibrand and Madeleine Albright. Like, I can't imagine Madeleine Albright sitting there listening to him talk. I mean, presumably she just gave her talk and left and didn't listen to him, and not say, like, what? Like, they have this data that can tell if I'm neurotic and then target ads at me, perhaps political ads. Like, no one questioned it then?
No one questioned it then. In fact, what was amazing about that speech was it was really it wasn't exactly the high watermark for Alexander Nixon, Cambridge Analytica. I would say that Trump's election, in which Cambridge Analytica took credit for it and said that they were integral and instrumental and so on, that was probably the high watermark. But that speech was really a sort of public emergence that we hadn't seen of Alexander Nix and Cambridge Analytica and this model, this approach that he was talking about. And just so that, you know, your viewers, your subscribers understand, Cambridge Analytica pitched what it called behavioral micro-targeting. It talked about psychographics. That's all fancy terminology for saying we're going to use all the data that campaigns already have, your shopping data, your demographics, your voting data, all the stuff that's out there already that Clinton used and Obama used in 12. But we're going to marry that data with information about your personality. And this is where the Facebook data came in. Cambridge used the Facebook data to craft these personality profiles. And so Cambridge was saying, we're better than the other guys out there because we have all these profiles, 230 profiles on 230 million Americans, the entire voting age population. And we know which people are neurotic, which people are agreeable, which ones are fun-loving, which ones are leaders, and which ones are followers. And we can target and persuade people even better when we know that about them. And at this Concordia summit, you have Alexander Nix really selling the, and this is the pure, straight, unadulterated vision of his company. And at that point, everyone bought it. And it was the hot new thing. Wired magazine, love them as I do, listed him as one of the 25 geniuses who are creating the future of business. He was on top of the business at that point. And it really isn't until after the 2016 presidential election ends, and that there is a mass of people in Republican politics who are raising questions more vocally than ever, that questions are asked and doubts start to creep in about, okay, this guy, when he was on stage, is this legit or is this more salesmanship than substance?
Yeah, I think what's depressing about all this is that, you know, by and large, this is just how the online marketing industry works. And for a certain amount of time, you know, up until the last couple of weeks, let's say, it worked this certain way. And then we realized that, hey, it just got a little too good. And there was also a lot of dishonesty behind the scenes. Obviously, that's a really big part of this, too. But I mean, peeling all of that away, like, this is just how it's been for years. And we've known it's scummy. And yet we still seem to be okay with giving all of this information away for something, for use of the service or whatever. So, I mean, in some ways, I guess we're just as culpable as anyone else for being okay with giving that information to begin with.
But this moment is certainly I think a watershed moment and a teachable moment for a lot of people. I mean, yeah. people that are professionals, my mother, I mean, everyone I know who's on Facebook, who's on Twitter. I mean, I was having a conversation the other day with someone, and it had just occurred to this friend of mine that all the free services that you get through Google, you know, Gmail, Docs, Sheets, Drive, all of that, that all feeds data back into Google that, yeah, Google uses in not just to improve its services, but in other commercial ways as well. I mean, we are so accustomed to these free platforms, these free online tools, and just using them and not really just diving in and not really thinking twice about it. And yet I do think that this moment, though, has really snapped people's heads back and caused a lot of folks to say, okay, what am I opting into here? And where is my information going? And is it going to go somewhere that I don't want it to and that I don't agree with?
And is it going to go somewhere that the company itself doesn't even know where it's going? That's what I'm more afraid of. Like, I don't necessarily think Facebook or Google are the enemy here. I think they've just lost control of it a little bit. They've opened Pandora's box, like, to use a cliche. And I don't think all that toothpaste isn't going to go back in the tube.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so either. And there was a former Facebook employee who submitted evidence to the committee in Parliament that's investigating all of this, the committee that Christopher Wiley testified before yesterday, I believe it was. And this former Facebook employee said, look, I mean, there are tens of thousands of people who use the tools on the data tools on Facebook between whatever it was, you know, 2010 to 2013-14, where you could go in, you could just create a quiz, you could create a game, you could create some sort of app. And with that app, you could extract not just data on the people who played your game or took your quiz, but their friends as well. And I mean, it's the thing that struck me too about the story was thinking about Facebook in the, you know, in years past. I mean, 2009 was not, relatively speaking, that long ago, but Facebook was an entirely different beast back then. And the amount of data that you could pull off and the amount of things that you could put into Facebook have changed so radically. And while Facebook has tightened a lot of that, mostly for its own self-interested purposes because it's been able to monetize that, that data, I mean, you can't claw that data back, as you point out. I mean, that data is going to be floating around and used for a long time, and there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, we're seeing it now with Cambridge Analytica, but that's just one company out of thousands that made use of this data. And so our personal data is out there. It's going to be out there. It's something we just have to resign ourselves to at this point, unfortunately.
Andy Kroll is an investigative reporter for Mother Jones. He is also on Twitter at Andy Kroll with the K. Thank you so much for joining us, Andy.
Thank you, Andy.
And my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
It was a pleasure talking with you. All right, finally, of all the things we hope to instill in our children, at least I'm speaking for myself, it's a general sense of money management, because let's face it, it's not something that's taught very well in schools these days. Technology enables connected parents to introduce financial practice and theory to children in new ways that, at least we hope, will lead to a grown-up that isn't intimidated by the complex world of finance and investing for their future. And joining us to talk about the system and app that he created for his own children and now is available to everyone else to accomplish this is Greg Moret, father of six and founder of Busy Kid. Welcome, Greg.
Hey, good to be with you.
Apologize. I said Moret, it's Merced.
Mercy on me.
Okay. Yeah, so you've got a little experience here with teaching your kids the ins and outs of finance. So let's start with kind of the beginning, the germination of this idea of Busy Kid. Talk a little bit about how you created this and why.
Sure. So the real reason I did was because I've been a certified financial planner for almost 20 years. And I've been working with mainly business owners. And those business owners always seem to have two things in common. They knew how to work hard, and they knew how to make smart money decisions. And because of that, I started like that light bulb moment. I need to get those two things into my kids so that they can get out of my house and make something of themselves and never come back except to visit once in a while.
Get out of my house and make something of yourself.
That's your founder story. I just wanted my kids out of my house.
Exactly. I just wanted to be left alone. So I literally, that is how it started. And so I thought, okay, how do I do that? And I think it's an interesting concept these days because it's this idea of financial abstraction, which means essentially invisible money. And we're trying to teach our kids about something that they actually never see or rarely see. And so it's pretty hard and it's challenging. And so we have to do that in a technological way. And so that's really what Busy Kid is. I sometimes describe it as your kid's first job with direct deposit. And that's really what it is. You assign chores to your kids. They do those chores. They earn money. And then we send out a text message that says, hey, Johnny earned $15 this week. Do you want to pay him? Yes or no? And a parent just has to simply type yes to a text message. And that automatically moves the money from their checking account or debit credit card into our system automatically. So we've really kind of simplified this whole kind of nightmare of allowance with parents and kids.
Right. Yeah. One struggle that I've had with my children, I have an 8-year-old daughter and a 4-year-old daughter. So my 4-year-old's still pretty young for this stuff, although she does get an allowance and she enjoys spending it on stuff that I would never spend my money on. But anyways, I give her that freedom. But anyways, with my 8-year-old, the struggle that I've had around money is that, you know, I mean, I've lived my life long enough where cash was the main way to go. Like, it was in your hand. It's tangible. Now, obviously, we're not there, right? So much of this is online. It's virtual in the form of a debit card or, you know, a credit card or whatever. And so I kind of struggle with that. Like, on one hand, I want her to see the tangible qualities of money. But on the other hand, the way it is right now, like, we got to get them trained for the way the money reality that we live in right now. And you do that through a number of different ways. You've got the Visa card. You have Payday Fridays, where basically every Friday they get paid. Stock market investing, charitable donations. You include a lot of stuff in this service with Busy Kid. how do you not overwhelm children when being introduced to this granularity around money?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You just do it a little bit at a time. And as they get older, you start challenging them more and more. So, and I think the main thing that we want to try to, you know, get across as a kid is that we're teaching reality. And your point is exactly on, which is cash isn't really around anymore. And the reality is that money's invisible. And so it's digital, right? We're teaching reality. If a parent goes to work, they go to work, they earn some money, and that money comes to them, usually electronically, and then they save some. Maybe that's a 401k with stocks and mutual funds or whatever. Then they share some with charity or church or whatever that way, and then they spend the rest. So this very much mirrors reality. It's not some, you know, digital experience just for fun. It's not a virtual experience. This is mirroring reality so that they're prepared when they leave the nest or even before they leave the nest to make these kinds of decisions. And so reality is super important to us.
I have my kids are a little bit older. I have 2 12-year-olds and a 14-year-old. And I have this weird problem that I hope it's not just me, but my kids are so comfortable with technology in all ways except for with money. They still want cash. They still, like, when they go to the movies with their friends, they want, you know, I've used half a dozen different allowance apps. They don't like to do that for some reason. I've tried the debit cards and like I just can't get them used to it. And yet it's not like they're really super careful with cash. Like I end up, you know, picking 20s out of the dryer when I'm folding laundry. So how do you convince
you're just
I know that's my extra source of income. That's my side hustle, doing the laundry.
I have 3 or 4 boys that I can send over to your house if you've got that much money laying around.
Okay. That sounded like they would, yes. My daughter babysits, so you can make a lot of money babysitting. And so that, sure. I guess, you know, she just likes having cash for emergencies. I don't know. But so how do you get like a little bit, like if you didn't start early, how do you get kids a little bit older to be accustomed to this? What's their incentive?
Well, I think the incentive is you kind of have to get them involved in, once again, it all boils down to the connection of two things. It's the work ethic and it's the money management. If you can get those two things started with them at a very early age, the likelihood of them being successful kind of in their own right goes way up. And so I would say, you know, the incentive is show them, wow, I can purchase, instead of sitting around and watching Netflix all the time, I can purchase, you know, some fractional shares of Netflix and watch them grow. Watch them go up and down. Understand that. I think that's some incentive to help them understand that stuff is when they actually own it themselves.
Now, a big part of the service of Busy Kid revolves around doing chores and then being paid for those chores, being paid for the work. And that very much obviously, you know, reflects what us as grown-ups, I think I'm a grown-up, experience on a daily basis.
Are.
You work, you get paid.
Greg says
sometimes I don't feel like I'm a grown-up down inside. But anyways, one school of thought is that we shouldn't be paying for chores, that doing chores is simply part of being a part of a functioning family dynamic, yeah. Right? It's a responsibility.
I don't
everybody,
get paid.
Everybody, right, exactly.
Except for when I do the dry, when I do the laundry.
You pay big time when you do the laundry. Yeah.
So that's where the money's at. So what about the difference there, right? They're two totally different schools of thought. One is you do the chores and I pay you for your time. The other school of thought is, yeah, you do chores because we're all part of the family and we all chip in and make a functioning family, household exist. And then the allowance aspect is more about education, right? We give you an allowance, you learn how to do whatever you're going to do with that. What do you think about that?
So I've been asked that question 1,000 times, and I think it's a good question. And I think there's a lot of different philosophies about it. I kind of believe that, like, who cares? Okay. If you don't want your kid to be paid for brushing his teeth, don't pay him to brush his teeth. Okay, fine. If you don't think that certain things necessitate some payment, that's fine. And I understand, and I actually think that that's okay. But where are they going to earn some money otherwise to learn these financial fundamentals to once again get them out of your house? There's a point to all of this. And so if you're going to do it, have them do it at your own house. It's a perfect like little place to learn. And you can also get them to do things that you don't want to do. You can have them wash your car. You're the one driving them around in it all the time anyways. Those kinds of things are just like super important, but why not pay them for that and let them experience all of that? Mm-hmm. I don't know if there is a job out there that an adult can go and just show up, do all the work and not get paid. So I don't get it. Once again, reality is important, and really teaching kind of real things. Like you go and do a job, you get paid for it. Like that's how the real world works.
Mm-hmm. And I get that too. Like, I mean, sometimes, you know, there's extra landscaping stuff that you would pay for, or you'd pay someone else for. And then, well, if they can do it, yeah, then, you know, we'll see. So what if, hypothetically speaking, you are a parent who is not so great about managing her money? Asking for a friend. I want to be a good model. What would you suggest to parents to get better at this sort of thing?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think we as parents probably overthink this. I think we need to kind of get over it and let our kids know that we're not all that great at it. And that's okay. I think there's a lot to be said for transparency. We live in Arizona, and in Arizona in August, you can imagine the air conditioner never turns off. And because of that, we have a very high electricity bill, right? And so as opposed to just being the grumpy dad that says, close the door, the air conditioning's on, you know, I show them the bill, right? Which is email now. So I get an email and it says, you owe $750 for your electric bill this month, right? And most people are like blown away by that, and your kids will be blown away from it as well. And so I like to be very transparent and say, hey guys, look at this. I just got the electric bill. And then you let them see that number and they freak out, right? And I think that the same thing, we just need to be very open and transparent with our kids, and they're very understanding as well. I keep doing this, and one of our daughters is like getting after me all the time now and saying, why are we going out to dinner? Why are we remodeling the bathroom? Why are we doing all that stuff? It's a waste of money, right? So I think there's something about that. We don't have to be the perfect models with all this stuff. And if we make mistakes and, you know, we're spending stuff, money when we shouldn't and whatever, that's real too. And that's okay, and we can all learn from it.
Yeah, I completely understand and identify with that, right? Like we're our parents, and sure we are the people that they look up to most because that's just how it works in a family dynamic, but we're definitely not perfect. I know that one too much. Busy Kid, where can people find it? What like there's costs associated with this? How many licenses does that cover? How can people get started?
Sure. So we're everywhere. You can go to busykid.com. We're online, and we mobile website works great. We have an iOS app. We have an Android app. All of those things are very accessible to everybody. We've strategically priced this to any family can handle this. It's $14.95 per year per family. So you can have one kid, or you can have four or five, and if you're crazy, you can have six. And so that's the way it is there. Each spend card is $5, so it's pretty affordable with that as well. And I think at the end of the day, the best thing to do is do it, because I think the best way that kids learn is by doing this stuff. Mm-hmm. I think loading $50 onto the kid's Busy Kid card and they go to the store and buy some cheap thing that they really want and it breaks 2 days later, that's fantastic, because that kind of, you know, buyer's remorse, burn in your stomach kind of situation is going to stick with them. And then they're not going to do it again. If they're just buying everything with your money, they're okay with when it breaks, they just throw it away and expect another one. So this is super important, and the best thing to do is just do it with your kids and let them experience it.
Yeah, I've experienced that firsthand too. Because my 8-year-old daughter at this point has learned the lesson, but she would go to the store with her allowance. She'd get one of those blind bags, and those of you who don't watch YouTube probably don't know the terminology of blind bag. But they're these little.
You're teaching me something right now. I don't know what a blind bag is.
I don't
it's
either.
A little. It's a little plastic. Bag, you know, branded with like, you know, whatever the toy brands are, or whatever, and you don't actually know what you get inside.
So it's
a toy of some sort
that they're selling to you.
Basically, what it is it's like, you know, the machines that you go in, you put in 50 cents and you turn it around and you get some random thing. It's that, but maybe a step up from that. And she would spend her money on that, and she would hate, you know, like 10 minutes later. It's like this stupid little toy that she just didn't care about. And eventually she learned her lesson because that was her allowance. She spent it on that. She made that mistake, and now she doesn't do that anymore. And that's what it's all about, teaching them the lessons.
Super important.
Allowing them to learn it. So.
What a dad. You're amazing.
Well, I didn't create an app and give it to everyone else, you know, so allow everybody else to use it. So you're amazing, Greg. Greg Merced is the founder of BusyKid, BusyKid.com. Thanks for coming on and talking finance with us. We really appreciate it, Greg.
Hey, it was fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Best of luck with your service.
Take care.
Thanks.
And finally, some positive Facebook news.
Oh boy,
news.
Facebook again.
This is good news. A camera lost at sea for 2 years was returned to its owner in fully working order. A group of fifth graders from Yuming Elementary School in Taiwan found the Canon camera in a waterproof case growing barnacles and lichen. They took it out of the case and it still worked and still had some battery life left. So they turned not to Reddit, nor to Twitter, not even to Peach, but to Facebook, where they posted the photos contained on the camera. And that's how they found the owner of the camera, Serena Subakahari, who had lost it scuba diving in 2015. She's actually going to travel to, she lives in Japan. She's going to travel to Taiwan to meet the students that found the camera.
That's crazy. I mean, that's evidence of the network effect on Facebook, right? They put it on Facebook. It suddenly got shared just a gazillion times. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, that photo made its way back because, as we know, it's not 6 degrees of separation anymore. It's way less than that. So it probably doesn't take very long for something like this, if it catches the right viral wave, to get back to the person pretty quickly.
They probably could have just asked Facebook, like, whose picture is this? And they would be like, we know. We know everything.
We contacted Cambridge Analytica and we have this answer for you.
Just a little facial recognition and you're done. So it's a sweet story.
Yeah, and there was absolutely not a single drip of moisture inside of the container. It was 100% dry in there. It still held a charge. That's crazy.
I do think someone's probably done studies on this, but like Reddit is the place you often hear about this. But I've seen it on Twitter. Like I saw recently someone had found this photo of it was a bunch of scientists. And there was one African-American woman in the group and she was uncredited. And they wanted to figure out who she was, like who was this person from 1917 or something. And, you know, you see all these people and you watch it happen. Like you watch this crowd, you know, to get together and figure out these things. It's amazing. So I don't think that, I mean, there must be a way in which Facebook might be better for this than some other, you know, depending on who you're looking for.
Yeah.
I'm sure a data scientist would be able to tell me what's better at this Facebook, Reddit, or Twitter. But
I mean, the reality is if there were a couple of photos on that photo reel that had any clear pictures of faces, I mean, the information is out there and you know, the systems exist to identify who that person in that photo is. Would they have access to that capability? Probably not directly.
Yeah.
Facebook would, but not this classroom that found the camera.
Right.
And that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. You can be part of the show by emailing us. All you have to do is send that email to tnw@twit.tv. Sure, you want to send us your selfies? Go for it.
Yes, definitely send your selfies. Or post them on Twitter. I'm at Megan Maroney. Or you can, Jason Howell, you can tag him too. You can subscribe to our show, twit.tv/TNW. You can even come and visit our show. Tickets at twit.tv. You can sit right here and, you know, maybe we'll take a picture of you and see and post it on Facebook or Reddit and see all the people that know you.
Yeah, all those people over there. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
How's it going? No, it's actually empty over there.
Yeah, I already said everything.
That's okay. You said my stuff, and I appreciate it. It's good to be back. Thanks to Josh. Thanks to Jammer B. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Colleen and everyone who helps us do this show each and every week in here. And thanks for covering while I was out last week on a beach. I really appreciate it. You'll get your turn soon.
Yes, soon.
Thanks to you for talking tech with us on Tech News Weekly. We'll see y'all next week. Bye, everybody.